House Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform for the 92nd legislative session will come to order. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani.
Present.
Vice Chair Frazier.
Present.
Lee Johnson.
Present.
Representative Edelson.
Present.
Representative Feist.
Present.
Representative Grossel.
Present.
Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Hewitt.
Present.
Representative Cleavorn.
Excuse me, present.
Representative Long.
Present.
Representative Lucero.
Present.
Representative Mueller.
Mueller, present.
Representative Novotny.
Novotny, present.
Representative O'Neill.
O'Neill, present.
Representative Pinto.
Present.
Representative Poston.
Present.
Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh, present.
Representative Vang.
Present.
Representative Shung.
Shung, present.
And that concludes roll call.
Very well. Quorum is present. And again, Representative Hollins, thank you for your assistance there. This hearing is being conducted under Minnesota House Rule 10.01, allowing members to debate and vote by means of distant voting, remote electronic voting, or other means to allow legislative operations while preserving the safety of the public, staff, and members. The hearing may be viewed via the House, via a House webcast, and a link is on our committee website page for access to that. Those interested in testifying can email the committee administrator 24 hours before a hearing, Mr. Jamal Lundy. His email is found also on the committee website page. Members, we have four items of business today. We'll have adoption of our minutes. We will then hear a presentation from Dr. Maria Ponomarenko of the Policy or the Policing Project, a nonpartisan research and thought leadership collective that partners both with communities and with police to promote public safety through transparency, equity, democratic engagement. Members, this is a great opportunity to have a problem-solving discussion with someone who is part of a diverse partnership involving police chiefs, sheriffs, public safety directors, business corporations, city mayors, civil rights groups, and both conservative and liberal think tanks. This group, the policing project, brings new approaches to tough issues facing public safety. We will be touching today on a broader way to think about accountability and the importance of state regulations, licensing bodies such as our very own Minnesota Police Board. Following that, members, we'll switch from a conversation around regulations and regulatory bodies and accountability toward legislation. We'll be hearing Representative Vang's House File 717, a legislative effort to provide some redress to families who have lost loved ones to wrongful deaths involving licensed peace officers. And then finally, members, we will formally take up House File 3120 by Representative Miller, establishing a task force to develop ways to prevent labor trafficking, which is often tied to criminal sexual conduct, which we heard last week. And so the intent here, we couldn't act on that bill last week because we had not posted it in time, but we took testimony and had some conversations. The intent of the chair is to quickly move to a vote on moving this bill along. And so I'm not looking to prolong the discussion that we had last week, but rather to move this bill as quickly as possible, if that's the will of the committee, to move it along to other committees that have a much more direct jurisdiction over the proposed bill. So with that, Representative Hollins, since you bailed me out once, would you be willing to bail me out again and move to adopt minutes of the February 10th committee hearing?
Absolutely. Yes, Mr. Chair. I move that we adopt the minutes of, oh no, what day was it?
February 10th.
I move that we adopt the minutes of February 10th.
Very well. Thank you. You're two for two, I think. We'll see how successful you are with this motion. Representative Hollis moves adoption of the February 10th minutes discussion. Representative Johnson, voice vote, I think is fine.
That would be fine.
Very well. Thank you, sir. All in favor of the motion, Hollis' motion to adopt the February 10th minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
All same sign. Motion prevails, and the minutes from February 10th of this committee are hereby adopted. Thank you again, Representative Hollins. With that, I'm going to ask Dr. Maria Ponomarenko to come forward, give us, list her name for the record, and provide us with your thoughts and your testimony. Today, I'm really looking forward to our conversation. Welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you, and thank you, Chair Mariani, Vice Chair Frazier, and good afternoon, committee members. So first, I have some slides. Am I able? Let's see if I'm able. Yes, I am able to share. This is wonderful. Your Zoom is set up a lot better than ours. So let me just get this started. Terrific. So my name is Maria Pomarenko. I am an associate professor of law at the University of Minnesota Law School. And as Chair Mariani mentioned, I'm also the co-founder and counsel of the Policing Project at New York University School of Law. I think a lot about policing on a pretty day-to-day basis. So I teach criminal procedure. I also teach administrative law and constitutional law. I write primarily on state and local government law with a specific focus on policing. I'm an associate reporter on the American Law Institute's Principles of the Law Policing Project, which is a group of academics, police chiefs, lawyers, judges, prosecutors, and others who have come together to really think of a set of high-level principles to govern and inspire policing. And then finally, I helped co-found and am now counsel at the Policing Project at NYU Law, and it's largely in that capacity that I'm here today. So the Policing Project is basically dedicated to promoting transparent, equitable, safe, and effective policing through a variety of strategies. We focus a lot on bringing democratic voice to policing. We've been thinking a lot about kind of thoughtful regulation of police technology. We've started to think more broadly about, you know, reimagining public safety and really thinking about the role of policing. We've been working closely with police departments in more than a dozen jurisdictions on a variety of projects, including promoting neighborhood policing in Chicago and helping departments think through policy reform. And then finally, we're also focused on trying to bring more women into the policing profession through the 30 by 30 initiative, which is also co-led by us and a number of other organizations. My focus at the Policing Project is largely at the moment on our legislative work. So over the past year with an advisory body, again, including police chiefs, heads of major civil liberties organizations, academics, local government officials, we've been thinking about the role that states can play in promoting more sound and effective policing. And as part of that, we've been thinking a lot about post boards, which are the licensing entities in virtually all states that are responsible for licensing. So I was asked to come talk today specifically about the role that states can play, the state posts can play, and the role of licensing in regulating policing. So why licensing? There's a number of reasons to look to licensing as at least one lever through which the state can think about promoting a more effective police force. So, you know, the kind of underlying goal of licensing, and this is true for policing and for various other professions, is to ensure minimum standards across the board. It's the state that actually gives officers the authority to use force and law, and licensing is the means by which the state ensures that the police officers who are given this authority meet certain minimal standards. Licensing also recognizes that, you know, officer misconduct does not simply hurt the employing agency or even the local community in which the officer works. So when there are allegations of misconduct, that potentially hurts the profession as a whole. And when there's a perception that officers are not being held accountable, that officers potentially are fired by one agency and just get rehired by another, that doesn't just harm the local communities where these officers work, that affects the profession more broadly. Policing also affects the kind of broader criminal justice system. So courts and prosecutors and everybody looks to police to thoroughly investigate allegations of criminal activity, to enforce the law in an unbiased manner, to testify truthfully in court. And so when officers violate those kinds of principles, that's not just a problem, again, for the hiring agency. That's a problem for the entire criminal justice system that depends on officers playing their unbiased role. And then finally, as I mentioned, you know, licensing is one way that states have started to address what people have often deemed the so-called wandering officer problem. And this, again, is the idea that, you know, when officers engage in misconduct in one agency, they're often simply let go and allowed to continue to work elsewhere. And local agencies often either lack the information or the incentive to figure out exactly what happened at that prior agency. And we've seen a number of instances where officers go on to other agencies and end up causing pretty significant harm. Now, importantly, licensing is how we regulate a lot of professions. So if we think about kind of core public regarding professions like teachers or lawyers, licensing and the ability to revoke a license for misconduct is a big part of how the state regulates the profession. So here in Minnesota, a teacher's license may be revoked for immoral character or conduct, gross inefficiency or willful neglect of duty, failure to meet licensure requirements or ongoing training obligations, fraud or misrepresentation in obtaining a license. And notice a common theme here, which is, you know, this isn't being late to work. This isn't mouthing off to your principal. This isn't the sort of stuff that is specifically the focus of the particular school that's decided to hire this teacher. This is conduct that actually goes to their ability to work with students in any jurisdiction, which is precisely why the state steps in. And we see the same thing for lawyers. So I'm guessing there's a fair number of lawyers in this room, and this will all seem really familiar. So again, you know, lawyers may lose their license for criminal conviction, at least for certain offenses, deceitful or willful professional misconduct, willful violation of a court order, or willful violation of an attorney's oath or duty. And again, this isn't about the sort of conduct that is just the business of that specific employer. So if you're an attorney who engages in misconduct, your firm may fire you, your firm may take disciplinary action. But if you're lying to a court, if you're violating your duty to clients, that's no longer just the problem for the firm that's decided to employ you, that's a much broader problem for the profession as a whole. And this is precisely the role that state posts play in a majority of states. So at present, state posts in 47 states have the authority to revoke officer licenses. And in approximately two-thirds of those states, they can revoke an officer's license for misconduct in the absence of a criminal conviction. In terms of the grounds for discipline, you'll notice a lot of similarity to attorneys and teachers and other licensed professions. So in Georgia, for example, which has a particularly robust decertification regime, decertification, by the way, is another term for revoking an officer's license, engaging in criminal conduct, whether or not the officer is convicted, making false or misleading statements in the course of duty, engaging in any unprofessional, unethical, deceptive, or deleterious conduct that's deemed harmful to the public. And so again, this isn't showing up late. It's not misusing department equipment. It's not mouthing off to a supervisor. These are the sorts of violations that go directly to the core of whether somebody can actually be trusted to administer the criminal justice system and really operate as an agent of the state. See something similar in Florida, which is another state with a fairly robust system. So again, criminal conduct, whether or not the person is convicted, using excessive force against a member of the public, misuse of authority, lying to any law enforcement agency or court, or finally, discriminatory conduct. Now, in terms of, you know, how many officers are decertified, you'll notice there's a really large spread, and Minnesota sits at the very bottom. So in Georgia in 2015, 281 officers were decertified. In Florida, it was 102. Oklahoma, which is actually a somewhat smaller state than Minnesota, 58, Missouri, 53, Tennessee, 40, Kansas, 29, Arizona, 28, Arkansas, 28. And we have Minnesota that's almost at the very bottom of the list with just two officers decertified in 2015. That number goes up or down by a few. I'm using 2015 in part because that's the last time that there was a comprehensive study that actually compared all of the states. Now, to give you a flair for the sort of conduct that leads to revocation, I went to Arizona, which is one of the states that has a particularly strong transparency system. So they will post short bulletins on the State Post website describing in just a sentence or two what the officer was found guilty of doing and what penalty was assessed. And so these are revocations from 2019 that will give you some sense of what it takes for an officer to lose their license. So one case involved an officer who operated a vehicle while under the influence of alcohol. He then provided false and misleading information to responding officers. He told them he was not driving, and it later became clear that he was. So again, this isn't an officer who's simply violating the law. This is also an officer who's lying when found to be engaging in misconduct. And this goes not just to, you know, did the officer make a mistake and drive drunk, but it also goes to how trustworthy can they be? You know, officers like everybody else are going to find themselves in situations where they make mistakes, and somebody who makes a mistake and then lies to try to cover it up, that's going to be a problem for the criminal justice system as a whole. And that's going to be the sort of thing that may result in license revocation. Similar case, an officer committed an assault and disorderly conduct when he chest bumped and struck a juvenile in the face. And again, was untruthful when he told responding officers that it was in fact the juvenile who had attacked him. I'm guessing in this case, either body camera footage or other video showed otherwise. Again, you're going to notice a common theme here. So another case involved an officer who wrote false information in a police report. The officer claimed that he found drugs on somebody, and this person was in fact arrested as a result. And this last case really shows why it's so important to take seriously when officers lie on the job, because other people's freedom is going to be affected as a result. Yet another case, you'll see a similar pattern. Officer submitted 56 incident reports claiming to have engaged in certain investigative functions that the officer was not in fact performing. And yet another officer who authored 11 criminal reports in which he either omitted information or violated department policies, basically said that there was a reason for a stop that did not in fact exist. So in Arizona and in states like Georgia and Florida and Tennessee, this is the sort of conduct that state posts look to when deciding whether to suspend an officer or to revoke their license. Which brings me to Minnesota. So the Minnesota State Post was initially set up as the Minnesota Peace Officer Training Board. So its original limited function was just to certify police training academies and ensure a minimum level of training for all officers in the state. But in 1977, the state legislature very specifically reorganized the post as a licensing agency. So it was reorganized as the Peace Officer Standards and Training Board and was given the authority to both adopt rules with respect to minimum standards of conduct, which all officers were then bound by, and importantly, to suspend or revoke an officer's license for violation of those standards of conduct. So in 1977, the message from the legislature was, we want the state post to adopt minimum rules for what we expect from officers, and they to use the licensing system in order to enforce them. Unfortunately, that's largely not what's happened in the state. So although Minnesota has, post has had broad authority to adopt standards of conduct, they've largely refrained from doing so. So right now, under Minnesota post rules, a license may only be suspended or revoked for being convicted of a felony or gross misdemeanor. Notice it's not engaging in criminal conduct. It's actually being convicted in a court of law. Obtaining a license through fraud or lying to the board, but not lying to an employment agency, not lying to a court of law. Engaging in sexual harassment, using deadly force in violation of Minnesota law, and then a handful of other provisions. If an officer is deemed incompetent, for example, they will also lose their license. But when it comes to the kind of core focus of this hearing on officer misconduct, the post has really dramatically cabined its own authority in terms of what it may take action against an officer for. Now, the post is in the process of rethinking that system. So there's a set of proposed new rules that are slowly winding their way through the post process. As I understand, they're currently before the Rules Committee, which would actually use the post's authority to discipline officers on the basis of a much broader range of misconduct. So the new rules would allow the post to impose discipline, which can range from a warning or additional training to suspension or revocation of a license. For engaging in conduct that would constitute a felony or a gross misdemeanor, whether or not a prosecutor decides to bring criminal charges, providing false information to any law enforcement agency or court, or failing to turn over material evidence, using excessive force or violating duties to intervene or report, engaging in discriminatory conduct, and there's a number of other provisions as well. And so the post is currently in the process of stepping into the role that the legislature gave it in 1977. But at the moment, the Minnesota State Post really lags behind its partner agencies in a lot of states, including, as I'm sure you've noticed, a lot of very conservative states where licensing has long been at least one important tool in police regulation. The last thing I just want to add is, you know, I know the focus here is on licensing, and I don't want to undercut its importance, but licensing is still going to be just one tool in the toolkit for regulating policing. So licensing is one really important role that the state can and should play. In some ways, it's an absolute minimum if you think about it, but it's hardly the ceiling. So, you know, among the things that other states have done in recent years is provide for much more robust data collection than we have here in Minnesota, much clearer standards, not just around the use of force, but on the conduct of stops and other interactions with the public, and much clearer and stronger measures to ensure that agencies can hold their own officers accountable for misconduct. And so very admiring of this committee for focusing on the post and bringing much needed attention to the issue, but I hope you maintain a broader focus as well. And with that, I will stop my share and look forward to any questions.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Pomarenko. I needed to make sure I wasn't muted. I'm trying to learn my lessons here. There are several questions. Let me start very quickly with one, maybe two. And let me perhaps do a little devil's advocacy, if you will. So, you know, one argument might be in a state like Minnesota, we led, I believe, you know, other states in establishing advanced education for our licensed peace officers. Other states have followed in that. When I've spoken with, you know, some rank and filers and chiefs and directors, they have shared with me that they think that was a really critically important thing that we did, and that we certainly hope we never back off of that. So let me, and this is, you know, it's a speculative question, but, you know, so it's, you know, it's more about, you know, what the data might be telling you, but also just your gut feeling. If there could be an argument that says, hey, listen, we don't really need to have this strong centralized accountability system because, one, we're addressing quality right up front, you know, with, you know, good discernment, you know, skills, et cetera, that, you know, may be evident with, you know, advanced or with further post-secondary education skills. And two, that's really a local control issue, you know, let the locals. I know those are two distinct questions, but I'm also mindful of time. So I'm wondering if maybe you can comment on that relative to the wisdom of having a strong, you know, state-focused licensing accountability and using standards for ongoing licensing.
Sure. So, you know, I think with respect to your first question of, you know, don't standards at the front end do enough? You know, I think it's great that Minnesota has high standards for who can become a police officer. I think we all know from our day-to-day lives that finishing, you know, an associate's degree is not actually a proxy for, you know, being somebody who treats somebody with respect, who doesn't abuse authority, who doesn't lie or misuse their position in any way. And so, you know, it's really, really hard at the front end to screen for that. I think that there are ways we can screen better. So some agencies have started to look for people with demonstrated commitment to public service, people who have come out of, you know, social work or other service professions, people who have shown some desire to really work closely with communities in the way that I think we all hope our police will do. But even then, you know, we all, I'm guessing, had employees who you think are going to be really great, and it turns out that they're not. And the problem is when it comes to employees who also have the authority to use force against the public, to have the power of arrest, we can't just look to before the fact screening. And then as far as locals, you know, there's a pair of academics, John Rappaport at Chicago and Ben Grunwald at Duke, who they wrote a famous article on this wandering officer problem. And part of what they point out is, you know, officers who have been fired from one agency and move on to another, they often go to agencies who either don't know about the prior misconduct, they don't have the resources or the wherewithal to dig into an officer's history. Often they're not able to get the information. So an officer may resign in lieu of termination. And as part of that resignation, the agency promises not to say anything bad about them to a future employer. And the agency doesn't want the potential blowback on them in the future. Other small agencies they found may actually know that an officer engaged in misconduct, but they're just kind of willing to take the risk and hope that it goes okay. Usually officers move to smaller agencies that are, you know, less resourced, that don't have the ability to screen. But that's where the state has to step in, because, you know, you or I may be driving through one of those agencies and interact with one of those officers. And so, you know, bad policing doesn't stay within a particular jurisdiction. And when we're talking about lying in court, when we're talking about planting evidence, when we're talking about using excessive force against the public, that's not, again, as I started at the beginning, really just that one agency that's harmed. And so, sure, agencies can decide, you know, how much they're willing to put up with lateness or low-level misconduct. But when it rises to these kind of offenses against the public, that's where, you know, in a lot of states, the state licensing agency has stepped in.
Yeah, I agree, Dr. Ponomarenko, and I often tell folks that, you know, there is a tension with state and local control, and there should be. I think that's appropriate. But I often reflect and tell folks, you know, several hundred different standards is almost like no standard. And at some point then, it strengthens our ability, I would argue, to have a cohesive state and public safety system if there is a really important floor that's established at the state level, preferably arguably tied to, you know, our civil rights, you know, our duty to advance human liberties and freedoms, et cetera. But let me jump over to some of our other members here quickly. Representative Hollins, since you bailed me out before, I'm going to call on you first. Representative Hollins.
This is great, preferential treatment. thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, I feel like I'm gonna butcher your name, Ms. Ponomarenko?
Yeah, that's perfect.
All right, fantastic. I really appreciate everything you're saying here. And it was reminding me of, I'm a lawyer, and it reminds me of professional responsibility classes that we took in law school, where they really hammered home that we are a self-governing profession, and that we're doing this because we're going to be extra harsh on our own members because we want to make sure that other people don't take over and start saying, okay, you're not doing a good enough job, now we're going to tell you what to do. And so I think I understand the logic behind it, but I would love to know, I would love for you to expand on why, you know, states like Georgia and Florida are more aggressive in their licensing revocation than reform-minded states like Minnesota.
Sure. You know, there's a kind of a funny irony there. You know, the last three states that don't currently have authority to revoke officer licenses are New York, New Jersey, and Rhode Island. And so, you know, these kind of progressive bastions that are the very last ones, and California just recently adopted licensing reform, and so did Massachusetts and Washington state as well. Whereas, you know, states like Georgia and Florida, they've actually been doing this for a while. You know, nobody's really ever figured out exactly why, but I guess if I were to speculate, you know, partly this actually isn't a red or a blue issue. You know, I think everybody within the law enforcement profession can agree that the profession as a whole would be better off if it didn't have members who, again, kind of violated the basic oath of duty. You know, if you look at state posts, they're in every state dominated by law enforcement. They're either exclusively made up of members of the law enforcement profession or have a minority of public members like we do here in Minnesota and a number of states. But it's still law enforcement regulating law enforcement. And so in that sense, you know, I love your law example or lawyer example about, you know, us regulating ourselves so that other people don't. In some ways, it's, you know, state posts in these states have taken it upon themselves to ensure at least some minimal standards of conduct. You know, the examples that I gave from Arizona, I don't think there's anybody who's, you know, practicing in the policing profession who would look at it and say, that's who I want to hire for my next officer. You know, I want the guy who keeps lying to me and filing false reports. And so in some ways, it's not particularly controversial. Why have the blue states been late to move on it? You know, partly there may be something to do with unionization. So a lot of the states that have moved early also tend to be right-to-work states. There may also just be a kind of institutional culture that grew up in these states early on where it was just assumed that this was part of what the law enforcement profession would do. And it's been going on long enough that it's kind of sleepy and uncontroversial. You know, Florida also is kind of one of the leaders in police transparency. It's really easy to get complaint files in Florida and investigation records. It's, you know, a big sunshine state. Arizona's as well. You know, they've been releasing body-worn video of fatal shootings well before states like California and Minnesota started to think about it. And I think partly what it shows is you can have minimal regulation of policing without, you know, pushing people out of the profession or undermining their ability to keep us safe.
Representative Hollins?
That's insightful. It's really interesting. And I definitely want to probe more into this because I think that differentiation is really interesting. But thank you so much. I don't have any further questions.
Okay, well, Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Professor Pomarenko. That was a really terrific presentation. I just wanted to build on the point about comparing to other professions and just curious if you can, it seems like policing in general, the licensing standards and the ability to for oversight agencies to remove licensing is easier in other professions in general than it is for police. Certainly that seems to be true in Minnesota. And I guess I would think that'd be a good argument to say you'd want to go at least of equal, but possibly even the opposite direction, because you're talking about people who are authorized by the rest of us to exercise deadly force, et cetera. Can you just talk about sort of the deep rationale behind, I mean, is there a rationale to treat policing having lesser standards? If you just sort of comment generally about the comparison between these different professions. Thanks.
Dr.
Sure. You know, I think that there's, if anything, I think your intuition is right that we, you know, should be holding police officers to a higher standard. You know, both teachers and attorneys are people that we put a huge amount of trust in. You know, we trust teachers to be in a room with our kids on a day-to-day basis with fairly minimal supervision. We look to attorneys to represent us and, you know, potentially life or death matters. We also authorize police officers to do all of that, to interact with the public in incredibly fraught settings, and to use force in doing so, to be able to deprive somebody of their liberty. And so, you know, they're officers of the court in some ways, much like attorneys are. They're the ones who are bringing evidence to courts to then become the basis for possible conviction. But they're also people who we authorize to take action right there in the moment, often in circumstances where there isn't going to be much of a possibility to really review it after the fact. You know, body-worn camera footage has made it a little bit easier to scrutinize what happens in policing, but still lots and lots of interactions, it just becomes an officer's word against somebody else's. And so I think if anything, there's an even greater imperative to know that the people we've given this authority to are trustworthy, that, you know, if they've made a mistake, they're not going to be untruthful to try to cover it up, that they're going to be forthright, that they're going to be unbiased in their interactions, precisely because the authority we give them is just unmatched anywhere else in other professions.
Representative,
thank you.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Chair. Dr. Pomarenko, that was a great presentation. I really appreciate it. And I think the data, yeah, I hadn't seen all of that data in terms of states and how they've taken actions on officer license with decertification. And I think it's astounding when you look at those numbers. And particularly when you look at what's happened in Minnesota over the years, and you look at those numbers and you see how little action has been taken on some of the officers that we've had in our state. You know, and to that point, you know, it's our post board in about 50 years, in the last 50 years, they have rarely taken any actions to regulate licensing much further than what they've been directed to do by legislation. Can you opine a bit or give your thoughts on why you think our post board is not taking much action, even though they have the ability to take action and put rules in place to regulate the licenses more often?
Dr. Pomarenko.
Yeah, so, you know, you may or may not like this answer, but, you know, institutions work exactly as well as the people in power hope that they do, you know. So why is the state post not done as much? Because partly, you know, for a long time, the people appointed to the post were people who were appointed to not do that much. You know, over time, institutions build up a culture of either doing something or not. And, you know, when new people join that institution, they're either appointed specifically with that goal in mind, or they just kind of adopt those values. You know, the legislature has occasionally poked the post and given them a little bit more authority. You know, you'll see these periodic statutes that either direct the post to adopt model policies on a particular issue or to, you know, conduct periodic reviews. Then everybody kind of goes away and the post is left to do or not do anything. And I think, you know, the post has benefited a lot from obscurity. You know, most members of the public have no idea that there's a state licensing board and that when an officer engages in misconduct, that may be a place to go or that they should be pushing the governor to make better appointments. And so I think, you know, a lot of credit goes to this committee for a lot of the changes that have happened in the post in the past couple of years with, you know, much broader authority, or actually much more directive authority coming finally from the legislature. The governor has made some really terrific appointments in recent years. But honestly, it's partly on the Minnesota political establishment that the post has not used the authority that it's very long had.
Yeah, I would opine as well, Dr. Panamarenko, that sometimes that pressure comes from even outside of, elected officials. You know, a few years ago, there was a huge story in our state, really picked up and driven and narrated and researched by the media, relative to terrible state of affairs relative to conducting proper investigations of sexual assaults. And of course, most of the victims, being women, individuals with, other gender identities, et cetera. And that kind of pressure, I think, really did get the attention, of the members of the prior Pulse board. And so they began making some movements. We also subsequently legislated, but sometimes, that kind of pressure can come from different spots. Representative Frazier?
Thank you, Dr. Pomerenko.
All right, very well. Representative Rowley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do have a question for Dr. Pomerenko.
Please.
Thank you very much. So, Doctor, you had you'd said that according to the Post Board, that there would be situations where those that were engaging in conduct that would constitute a felony or gross misdemeanor, but were not actually convicted, could lose their license, or at least it was a suggestion of how that would work. In the spirit of opining, could you walk through situations or examples of where you've seen that? And then at the end of that, were there examples where after they lost their license, it was later proven that the crime was not actually committed, or afterwards the crime was committed? And did the Post Board or any other convicting agency use that to add additional crimes to it or additional charges?
Dr. Panamarenko.
That's a great question. So, the standard of proof for post boards is usually either kind of preponderance of the evidence, which is the regular civil standard. In some places, it's a substantial evidence standard, so something more. The way that this usually works is officers often don't get charged. So, the reality is, when officers, even if they're arrested on allegations of criminal conduct or in the course of their duties, they engage in conduct that would be criminal. So if we think about, planting evidence, lying in court, these are all crimes, but they're crimes that officers are very, very rarely prosecuted for. Prosecutors are very wary going after cops. Prosecutors also have very limited resources. And so, the way it would work is if there is an allegation that an officer engaged in some form of conduct that could be a felony or a gross misdemeanor, but they weren't charged, the post then has the authority to investigate. So the post here can delegate to another law enforcement agency in the state to investigate the matter. So again, it's just cops investigating other cops. They would bring the evidence to the post board, and then there would be a hearing, much like any other administrative hearing. The officer would be able to be represented by counsel. There would be access to evidence and testimony. They could put up their case. And at the end of the day, a hearing officer would determine whether it's more likely than not that an officer engaged in that conduct. And so, it's a somewhat lower standard of proof. It's not beyond a reasonable doubt, but it's the standard that we use throughout civil disputes and licensing disputes as well. As for your specific question of whether there's been cases where it later turned out that something didn't happen, I don't know off the top of my head, though. Partly it's because we don't have a ton of great, data and transparency over every single incident. I will say that virtually every state has a mechanism for an officer to be recertified. And so, you know, if an officer is decertified and they can come back 2 years later and say, look, you know, let me show you why I definitely didn't do this, that would fall to the post to then evaluate the evidence. And again, I would think because they're members of the profession that they would at least take that claim very seriously.
So different levels of standards that have been established in our decision-making legal systems. And seems to me that part of what anybody would need to decide is what is the level of standard needed to be able to hold the integrity of the standard that they've established, right? Representative Ollie.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And a follow-up to that. So do you have incidents or walk us through if an officer is brought before the board, and again, I'm focusing specifically on an officer that has not been convicted of a crime but has been accused of it, and I'm trying to paint this in a very specific way. So for this discussion, let's say that the officer has engaged in conduct that raised the level that the post board wanted to investigate. They were not convicted in a court of law, but the post board is looking at these allegations. Would a post board action, could it be used as an additional civil action later on? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Dr. Panamarenko.
So this is a problem that comes up in policing in general, because a lot of the, you know, what constitutes police misconduct often also could potentially give rise to criminal charges. So, you know, excessive force, that's either assault or homicide or, you know, depending on what the allegations are. But we have a pretty clear body of law for separating administrative and criminal processes. So first, you know, officers have a right not to be compelled to testify against themselves. And so if they're required to give a statement in the course of an administrative hearing, that can't be used against an officer as part of a criminal investigation. And so what actually usually happens is the administrative hearing is going to be told, or the administrative investigation is going to be put off until the criminal investigation has come to a close, in part because what everybody wants to avoid is a situation where an officer is forced to give a statement, that statement is then made public in some way, and now the officer can't be held criminally liable. And so states and agencies have done a really nice job of, you know, separating the two, figuring out the timing between the two, sometimes delaying the administrative investigation, walling the two off is another strategy. So making sure that different people are involved and that information isn't being shared across. But the short answer is no. So, you know, an officer who voluntarily gives a statement, that can definitely be used against them. An officer who's compelled to participate in an administrative proceeding, they don't lose that kind of basic Fifth Amendment right.
Thank you, Dr. Panamarenko. We have four other questions. I'm going to cut our questioning after these four. Representative Frazier, I think to this point.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, to this point. Dr. Panamarenko, Representative Riley, he asked you to kind of a hypothetical sort of situation around whether of when the post can take action if someone has taken, if an officer has taken some type of action that may be criminal in nature, but there isn't a charge for it. And I know most, you're probably aware of this, most recently we've seen the Jaleel Stalling case. And in that situation, those officers, it seems to be clear to me that they've taken some actions that in any other situation, if they were a citizen or a bystander, they would have been charged with criminal activity, at least charged. Not sure about the conviction, they'd have to go through the due process on the court proceedings. But in a situation like that, it seems our post board is hamstrung and they cannot take action against those officers because there has not been, there's not been a charge, there's not been a conviction at all. Can you talk a bit about that?
For sure. So that is exactly where the kind of core limitation is. So the post has that authority. They've just basically stripped themselves of it. So under statute, they have the authority to take action against anybody who violates any standard of conduct. And they have the authority to say that, you know, use of excessive force would violate the post standards of conduct. Having not done so, though, they are, you know, very likely hamstrung, and they are dependent on, you know, whether the Hennepin County prosecutor decides to file charges. And again, there's lots of reasons why prosecutors may not want to file charges. They're not sure they can get a conviction. They depend on police officers to bring them cases. And so they're in a little bit of a fraught position if they're kind of viewed as taking an overly aggressive posture. And it's precisely why, you know, states like Georgia and Arizona and Florida don't rely on prosecutors to decide who should be part of the policing profession. They give the post kind of independent, investigative, and adjudicative authority to decide that even if a prosecutor decides not to charge somebody, they maybe should not, you know, have their license or should lose it for some time.
Thank you, Doctor.
Mr. Chair, if I may. Yeah, I'll just quickly follow up. Yeah, I attended a post board meeting, and there were one of the post board members, a sheriff, who, you know, he thought the activity of those officers in the Jadil Stalin case was reprehensible. And I gotta imagine that him, that individual being a member of the post board, if he could, and if other members could, they probably felt the same way, they would have taken action against those officers and taken action against their licensure. And this is why it's vitally important that we move forward and that the post board does broaden their purview and start to do that. It will build trust between our communities and our law enforcement officers.
Indeed, and I think we also heard from Dr. Panamarenko that this is how many, if not most, licensing boards would function. Representative Otten.
Thank you, Chair Mariotti, and Dr. Panamarenko. Just to be clear and double back on what Representative Frazier was saying there, the case that he cited, you said that the post board could take action in that case with the existing statutes that we have?
They could. Well, so to be clear, they have the statutory authority, but they haven't promulgated rules that would give them the actual authority to act. So the statute says they can adopt standards of conduct. They don't have to wait for a criminal conviction. They've written their own rules in a way that says we're going to wait for a criminal conviction to decide to remove an officer's license. I will say one of the things that the post board rules do say is if an officer uses deadly force in violation of Minnesota law, that could be potentially a basis for decertification. But I'm not sure whether in that case that would have constituted deadly force. And I'm guessing that's, you know, within the post purview to figure out.
Really good question. Representative Otten.
Okay, thank you, Chair Mariani. Doctor, so my question before that I raised my hand for is we cite a lot of cases from out of state. Can you think of any cases that are not, as we sounds like you said, aren't already statutorily covered? Is there a case that we're trying to fix that wouldn't be covered currently?
Dr. Panama, I hope.
So the statute itself gives the state post incredibly broad authority. The reality is the post hasn't used that authority. And so, you know, legislature, first of all, could direct it to use that authority. So one thing the legislature could do is actually be much more specific and say that, you know, these following actions are a basis for decertification or revocation. And that's what a lot of states have done. So Georgia and Florida, a lot of these, they don't just say, you know, state post, figure out what you want to discipline officers for and go do it. The state statute actually says, you know, if an officer lies to, you know, any law enforcement agency or court, if law enforcement officer uses excessive force, engages in biased enforcement, that may be a basis for revocation, discipline, suspension, retraining, whatever the case may be. And so there's definitely something the legislature can do without waiting for the post, which is provide much clearer guidance of what you expect the post to do.
Yeah, and it seems to me, Representative Frazier, I'm not going to drag you in this, but just to acknowledge that I think your legislation that we heard a week or two ago proposes to take steps in this direction in terms of strengthening, you know, the strong authority already that exists in statute. Representative Abadi, then we'll go to Representative Johnson, then we'll close this out.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. So I just want to make sure that last time I checked, the post board is made up of all but one person, that is a nomination of the governor, and that you sounds like there you can't cite any cases that these changes would fix. Is that correct, Doctor?
Again, to be clear, it's very well within your authority to fix this problem. So you could wait for the post and say it's their problem to fix. They have the authority. It's not our fault that they're not losing it. But, you know, legislators in lots of other states, including states that, you know, very strongly support law enforcement, have given much clearer guidance to their posts on what they expect. And I would argue that, you know, most agree that we don't usually just go and tell administrative agencies, go fix this problem. Part of what legislatures do is they set basic standards. They say, you know, here's what we expect, and now we're going to delegate it to agencies to figure out how to implement it. What the current statute tells the post is basically, you know, go figure it out, and we hope you do it well.
Yeah, I would, and of course you're not from here, so you don't know this specifically, but I would argue that Jaleel Stallings' case is precisely a case where a specific case that the Pulse could address. A particularly egregious issue as determined by a jury in a trial where we've even had law enforcement individuals comment on the unacceptable conduct that was manifest in that case. Representative Johnson,
then we'll close out. Chair Mariani, members. Ms. Pomeranko, hopefully I didn't murder that too bad.
That was perfect.
I was listening to a lot of what you were saying, and that had some things I wanted to bring up. First of all, you talked about how the state does suspend or revoke licenses of teachers, lawyers, and also throw in doctors and nurses and a few other things, which is a little bit different than the law enforcement where a peace officer's license. All those other professions, they can practice in private business. You have a private nurse, a private teacher, a private lawyer, a private doctor. In fact, most doctors are private and they only have access to the hospitals they work at. They're not hired by the hospitals. They're a private doctor. Now, law enforcement's a little different. The only way to get a peace officer's license is if you work for the state. If you're not hired, your license is inactive. So that's the only place you can get a license is if you actually work for the state. We have a lot of officers that are terminated and never hired again. The reason they're never hired again is because of the process we have for hiring in Minnesota. One is a very intensive background check that I know some of them have gone on for almost a month and a half to 2 months, just doing the background check every single day working to find out what that person is like. Plus, we have to also have the psychological background test and it's surprising how many don't pass that. Now, we also talked about a little bit about the training. You mentioned Florida. I just looked up the minimum standards for Florida, and it's barely half a semester of course compared to our minimum 2 years college plus the skills course. Our skill course is almost as long as their entire course for their whole program to get a license. So it's like comparing oranges to grapes, a little bit, or a nice big orange that we have in Minnesota. We do our best to get the best possible. In fact, Florida is one of the biggest recruiters out of Minnesota college systems for law enforcement officers. California, Texas, they've all done something like we have, but not nearly the education requirements and the training requirements that we have for our officers. Do we have the occasional bad one? And we do our best to weed them out, because there's no cop that wants a bad cop out there, because it's not just good for the department. It's good, it's not good for the department or for the guys who work in it. We've had issues where we've actually had persons terminated and the judge gave them their job back. That happened in a department I worked at. his license had been revoked and the judge ordered Post Board to reactivate it. So I think Post Board was originally set up for standards and training and to revoke the license of somebody who did something egregious, such as committing a crime and being convicted of it. A lot of departments, if you're involved in that, they get terminated and they're never hired again because of the background requirements that we've put in place for a department to hire somebody. They don't want to hire a bad person. They're going to spend the investment and look into those individuals before they actually give them their job. And then also, you talked a little bit about the complaint at the Post Board. The problem I see with it is I've dealt with it in the department I work for. We had a gentleman that any time an officer would have to deal with him, he would file complaints. He would file complaints against officers who were not even working that day or were not there, but he'd file complaints against them. And it was nonstop. It got to the point where the officers couldn't even be around him without a audio recording going on because of the amount of complaints. And I know we've had issues dealing with that, giving Post Board some of the bills we have, giving Post Board that authority and doing those types of discipline and taking those complaints and keeping track of them. Phil, they do keep track of them now, but they don't keep track of the person making the complaint, which is just as important. Because if somebody making a false complaint against officers continuously or making complaints against officers continually, whether they're false or not, if they're making that many complaints, there's another problem that we need to look at. So it's not just one side, it's gotta be looked at both sides. So that's what I wanted to get at a little bit. And you also talked a little bit about those examples that you were talking about, different scenarios. Most of them would have been, I believe the vast majority would have been handled internally with either termination or suspension in the department and have been in their personnel files. If they ever went to another job or looked elsewhere, those things are available and they are looked into before any hiring in a different position. So I just want to let you be aware of that. And Minnesota is a lot different than the vast majority of states. We do have probably the highest training requirements before you can even apply for a license or obtain a job in law enforcement in this state. So I want to thank you for the work you've done. And some of the stuff I agreed with on your presentation, some of the stuff I did have concerns up because of the way it was presented.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Johnson. As our minority leader, I always want to make sure that we give you a good time to be able to frame up perspectives from our one of our parties here. Dr. Panamarenko, I'll ask you just to wrap up some comments here, and then members, we are going to push forward. Dr. Panamarenko.
For sure. I mean, I think the part that I want to underscore is, you know, Post Board reform, it's a limited reform that's meant to solve a very specific problem, which is when officers engage in very serious misconduct that as a state we've decided we actually don't trust that officer to pick up a badge and a gun and move somewhere else. And so, you know, to the extent that it turns out to be a limited problem in Minnesota, that's going to be less for the Post to do. But I'm not sure that that's an answer to say that, you know, the Post shouldn't have this authority because we have the problem solved. I think there's unfortunately been just far too many incidents here in Minnesota of officers who, you know, as we later learn, have very long histories of misconduct that unfortunately their home agencies have not taken seriously. And so I would really urge this committee to consider possible legislation or at the very least to, you know, be supportive of the state Post's current rules overhaul. But thank you for having me. And again, it's been really terrific to talk with all of you.
Likewise, Dr. Panamarenko, thank you for giving us your time and thank you for the work that you and your colleagues do particularly at the policing. Let me make sure I get the right name. What's the name of the
project?
Yes, policing project. My goodness. Look forward to continuing our connection with you and with the project as well.
Thanks so much. Have a great
day. Members, we do have two bills. We have 30 minutes. One bill we're going to lay over, and so we're going to try to get through that as quickly as possible. The other bill, we heard testimony last week, and so the chair's intent really is to take action on that bill so that it can continue its path to the necessary committees that lay before it. And so with that, Representative Bang, we're going to lay this bill over, but just to put it into play, Representative Bang moves House File 717 be referred to the, looks like it's referred to the General Register. Representative Bang, your bill is before us. Tell us about your bill, and then there's, you have, I believe, an author's amendment. We can pick that up right away if you wish. And then there are several amendments and then a few folks that want to testify as well. So Representative Bang.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we can move the author's amendment first and then I can speak on the bill.
Very well. Representative Bang moves adoption of the 822 amendment. Representative Bang, to your amendment.
Members, this is a simple amendment. It just changes the title of the bill to Justin Tigan's Law, which is the reason why we are bringing this bill forward. I think it's great to, it's important for us to remember that as policymakers, we know how policies affect families. And so this is a reminder for us to keep that top of mind. And I ask for your support.
Very well. Representative Agnes would put the bill in the shape that you wish it to be before us. It's our custom and usage to allow the authors to do that. Representative Johnson, I believe a simple voice vote would suffice to do that.
That'll be fine.
Very well. Thank you, Representative Johnson. All in favor of the 822 amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. And the House File 717 is adopted with the 822 amendment. Representative Vann, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Justin Tigan's Law does two simple things. It repeals the statute of limitations for alleged sexual abuse cases and alleged wrongful death cases by a peace officer and gives a 5-year retroactive window. More importantly, this bill is a bill about healing and allows a pathways for justice for families. It is an important tool for families to bring forth claims and hold bad police officers accountable. Being a police officer is an honorable profession. There is no doubt that we all respect good and reasonable police officers, and there are many, many of them out there. But there are such things as bad policing, and when that threshold is crossed by the officer, there must be action to address the harm that has been caused, and this bill does exactly that. I know that upon hearing this bill, there's been some concerns that has been expressed, and there's been written testimony from notable law enforcement that are valid, mainly about the repealing of the statute of limitations. This is something that I'm willing to address as long as the investigatory period is not concurrent with the statute of limitations. The purpose of this bill is to give families enough time to address their case while also recognizing the timeliness of having a civil case action. And with that, Mr. Chair, I have testifiers here today to speak on behalf of this bill.
Thank you, Representative Bang. And members, we did hear this bill in the past. So we've certainly had it heard in judiciary last year. It's my interest to make sure that this issue not just linger on the vines, particularly because there are family members, families that have been impacted over the years, and they've worked awfully hard on this issue. So with that, we're gonna hear from two testifiers. I'm gonna ask our testifiers to respectfully ask to be brief just because of the time that's involved. And first we're gonna hear from Tashira Galloway and Monique Coulars, Dodi and Ms. Galloway, it's always good to see you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and give us
Tashira, to Sherry Garraway. I want to first just say thank you so much for you guys to just go ahead and put that in Justin's name. I fought really, really hard for this and for me to be able to at least call my mother-in-law and tell her that you guys did at least put the bill in his name means the most. So I just wanted to say that I'm sorry for being emotional. But when you have been fighting for 12 years for justice for your loved one, and to hear that his name will be in a bill, that's an emotional moment. Because we've been fighting to even be heard for 12 years. I want to say that not only am I the person that Justin was with, I am the mother of his now 15-year-old son. Justin Tiger was brutally beat to death by the St. Paul police August 19, 2009, and thrown inside of a trash dumpster. I have been followed. A lot of things have happened that really intimidated me and made me scared to come forward. Even being on this call today is hard because I've lived this, you know, I've lived the fear. I want to say that I am not against police and that I actually have good police friends that I know are good people. It's about treating people right and treating people fair in the community, no matter what your position is, no matter if you're a nurse or a doctor. I used to work as a CNA, and if I did something wrong or if I seen someone do something wrong, I had to stand up for what I knew in my heart was right. So that is what I am fighting for, and that is what my heart is about. My heart is about fairness. My heart is about healing, and my heart is about safety, public safety for all human beings. Even police officers need to be safe. And so I just want to say that I work with families. I started a support group January 22nd of 2020, where I provide support group meetings every single week for the last 2 years, for before George Floyd was killed, for the families that had lost loved ones at the hands of law enforcement. For so long, I was just so burdened with my pain and felt afraid because I was out here fighting for justice alone with his mom, that I finally decided I needed to do something to help other people. I will tell you, from the work that I now do to help these families, including Philando Castile, Dante Wright, now Amir Locke, the families that you've heard about, George Floyd family, working with those families that were not covered up, because we have over 470 murders in the last 20 years. If you want proof of that, we can give you that at the hands of law enforcement here in the state of Minnesota, of Black and Indigenous and minority people. And we just want our fair day. We're nothing but families, human beings, that this bill does not give justice just right off the bat. The only thing that this bill does is give everyone the fairness of having their fair day in court. So if an officer did nothing wrong and, you know, they need to get their license back or they need to go back to work, that can happen. But at least everyone gets their actual fair day in court. That's all that this does. So I just want to say that. I want to say that in order for the community to actually heal and build relationships with police officers in the community, we have to be transparent. We have to be honest. And there's no way of healing without getting that day in court to actually figure out if there was some wrongdoing or if there was no wrongdoing at all. So that's what I want to testify to today. I'm missing a bunch of stuff and I have a lot to say, but I know we're on a time limit. So thank you so much.
All
Thank you, Tashira. Always good to see you. And then I think we have Monique Kular-Stoney as well. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Very well. Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. Please give us your name. And
thank you for having me.
Please give us your testimony. We are pressed on your time, but
okay.
No disrespect to you, please.
Understood. I'm Monique Kular-Stoney. I'm out of Marcus Golden, killed by St. Paul Police in 2015. I'm also the co-founder of Black Lives Matter Twin Cities Metro and Black Lives Matter Minnesota. But professionally, I have been a risk manager and an insurance manager. So I have walked in the world of, and still do, in the world of accountability in terms of risk mitigation and various outcomes, how things can be insured and transferring liabilities. So this is the arena in which I think on a daily. So it was the 2013 Child Victim Act passed in Minnesota, which at the time was considered the nation's most expansive law in terms of child molestation. That gave me the idea. That was the foundation for what is now, and I'm so proud and happy for Tashira, Justin's Law, Justin Tigan's Law. So the basis is set on a premise which has already been accepted by the legislature, right? That when these children were in a situation which they were vulnerable, why? Because the children did not have control of the information, the situation, or the families. They were in positions, particularly with the churches and the Boy Scouts, right? Where trust, the assumption was trust. They trusted the Boy Scout leaders, they trusted the priests at the church, and that is very similar to what was happening with people who were being killed by the police before the Black Lives Matter movement. They had no avenue or were not even necessarily believed. It was very difficult, but the Black Lives Matter movement began to expose the injustices within the police system. Also with, you know, more cell phone footage and video recordings, things have changed, right? So when we compare what the ask is for the Justin Tigan law, as we're comparing it to the 2013 Child Victim Act, the police controlled the narrative, just as the Boy Scouts and the priests controlled the narrative. There was no outlet. It was not well known what was happening. And all of a sudden, we have these people coming forward. This happened to them. A priest did this when they were a child. And that law gave people who, you know, over 25, I believe they had like 3 years to file a lawsuit, because these children, their lives had been so traumatized and negatively impacted. And that impact was being acknowledged by removing that statute of limitations, right? When children were going to church and Boy Scouts, the parents had trust, right? We have a community that has a great deal of trust for the police. But if you are Black, you're brown, you're indigenous, you are poor, your interaction with the police is different. But because there is so much trust and support for the police, even when wrongfully convicted, right? Because we just have to admit that there are people who are racist and do not want to see Black people thriving, right? One difference between the Child Safety Act and Justin Tigan's law is that what we do know is that 17 years ago, the FBI put out a report that white supremacist organizations are infiltrating police departments. And they did not know what the outcome was going to be, but we can see what some of that outcome is. So with the police controlling the narrative, putting information out in the papers without it being counteracted before the Black Lives Matter movement, families like Tashira's had no recourse. They had lawyers who were not getting information to even file the lawsuits, and then the time was passing by, and they were missing deadlines. So that was the foundation for the thought about removing the statute of limitations, because these people, like Tashira, need the opportunity to have the truth told, right? They need time to have the investigations. They need the information that the police held onto and wouldn't share with their lawyers. I know Tashira had multiple lawyers. I know of others as well. But it is a time. The light has been shown upon what has happened with policing now and even in the past. So this is why this is such an important act. So just like the families and the individuals who were molested as children were able to seek some type of restitution from the Child Victims Act, so should the families of the people who were killed by police. And also, you have to understand that when these children were molested, they were afraid of the priests and going to church or going to Boy Scouts or whatever. But we're talking about the police who are interacting. We're talking about people having their loved one killed and being traumatized, followed, or having surveillance put on their phones, all kind of things. So there was a great opportunity for the police to repress the truth and even stop the families from filing complaints. So this is why this legislation is so important and significant, and it is the right thing to do. And the precedent had been set already with the Child Victim Act, and it should go forward with the Justin Tigan Law just the same. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Collins-Doty. Thank you for reminding us of the Child Victims Act and some of the similarities with this. All right, with that, I'm going to call on Justin Terrell, and then we're going to move to some amendments here. Mr. Terrell, welcome, as always.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. Once again, it's a pleasure to be here with you all and the members of the committee. I want to say thank you to Representative Vang for bringing this bill forward and for the amendment to recognize Justin. It is appropriate, and I think the community is thankful for that. I also want to shout out Dr. Ponomarenko, who sits on the Research Steering Committee at the Minnesota Justice Research Center, where I'm the executive director, and we're currently working on a report to the Post Board on the changes to the Post Board, just to reference the bill that was the discussion that happened before this bill. I know I'm short on time, so I will get to the point so you guys can get to your business. And I'll just say that, look, I spend a lot of time with officers in the community. I know that there's good officers who show up every day to serve our communities. And I want to just name that this bill, which would extend the statute of limitations, removing it in the case of sexual conduct and sexual misconduct and death, is just a smart idea to be able to give people an avenue to seek justice. As you have noticed, and the world has noticed, we have been in the streets marching for years now, and it is time that and it is the work of this committee to continue to create accountable measures for folks who seek to serve our communities. The bottom line is you can't do this work without trust. I would be remiss to just not mention a couple of situations going on in the community right now. In my neighborhood where I live, Jamiri Rice was murdered in front of his school. And law enforcement showed up and made some arrests within 4 hours. In the case of Amir Locke, law enforcement tragically took the life of Amir Locke, but made an arrest in the killing of Otis Elders. Black communities call on law enforcement often. Sorry, that's my timer. It was supposed to be on vibrate. Black communities call on law enforcement often and are asking for their help in this uptick of violence that's a national trend. And when we do that, we need to be able to trust. We need to be able to trust that they can be held accountable if they cause irreparable harm. I know we're short on time, so I will conclude my comments there, but I just wanted to make clear that these issues are connected, that it is wise to make sure that community members have an avenue for justice, to seek justice in these moments. And I have to acknowledge my sister Tashira's tears. I just ask that you all take those tears into account with the work that you are doing and you continue to advance this bill. I'm sorry I'm short on time. I wasn't able to make my points, but I appreciate the opportunity, and I will end my comments there. Thank you.
Creating avenues for justice is always a good point. Thank you, Mr. Terrell, as always. Representative Vang, there are amendments before us. I'm seeing an A1 amendment. Is anyone offering the A1 amendment?
Sure. I think that's mine.
Very well. Representative O'Neill moves the A1 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this amendment is pretty simple. It simply extends, instead of
having in statute 3 years, it would double that to 6 years of statute of limitations. And it would put it in line with a whole lot of other things, which we don't have a lot of time to talk about since we have 5 minutes left of committee, but there is a long list of things that are already at 6 years. At 4 years is like medical malpractice, at 3 years is a wrongful death and a few other things. So this is further down the road, giving more time than even a wrongful death. And so I feel like this is a reasonable compromise, and I certainly see the need from someone who was a chief author of a bill to eliminate statute of limitations specifically for rape. And of course, that's a criminal case and this is civil, so it's not apples to apples, but I understand the merit there. My concern would be the evidence can be lost, witnesses can be lost and things like that. So I felt like doubling it was a fair and equitable way to do it. And I certainly see the need to extend it past 3 years. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very well, thank you, Representative Olivia. I think there's an A10 amendment to the A1 amendment. Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would offer the A10 amendment to the A1 amendment, which I think Representative O'Neill, in looking at that reasonable increase, I would just ask that we adopt the A10 that would say that 6 years would not start until the investigation with the BCA would be complete.
Very well, Representative O'Neill.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I understand why you would want to do that. My concern is that can take a very, very long time. And I'm just wondering if you have any data at all to let us know kind of how long investigations like that do take so that we know what we're extending it for. So my offer was, and my suggestion was to go from 3 to 6 years, which again is in line with a lot of other civil cases. I'm wondering if Representative Edelson, if you could get us, if you have some data to know about how long those investigations take.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think actually that's the point, is to make sure that that family does have time to have justice, to make sure that that investigation is complete. Mr. Chair, I don't know if anybody here, if their staff or I know Representative Pinto, my colleague, might possibly have a general idea as well.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for the thanks for Representative Edelson and Representative O'Neill. I mean, it seems to me, of course, investigations may take several years, but to my mind, that would be all the more reason that we want to make sure that families, I mean, if it's taking several years, presumably it's because it's a complicated situation, and we want to make sure that families then have the time once that's done. So it seems to me that anchoring your time limit in to have it start once sort of the rest of the process is over and then the family's given this time, to my mind, that makes a lot of sense.
Okay, very well. Members, we're going to vote on the A10 amendment to the A1 amendment. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frazier.
Aye.
Lee Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Edelson.
Aye.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Grossel.
No.
Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Hewitt.
Aye.
Representative Cleavorn.
Aye.
Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Lucero.
No.
Representative Mueller.
Mueller votes no.
Representative Novotny.
Aye, no.
Representative O'Neill.
O'Neill, no.
Representative Pinto.
Aye.
Representative Poston. Representative Poston. Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh, no.
Representative Vang. Representative Sean?
Aye.
And Lee Johnson, just running it with you again?
Change from yes to no.
And that concludes roll with 11 ayes, 6 nays, and 1 absent.
very well, the motion does not, or the motion prevails and the A1 amendment is amended. Members, to the A1 amendment, the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani.
And members, for the record, this is the A1 amendment as amended with the A10 amendment. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani.
Aye.
Chair Mariani, aye. Vice Chair Frazier.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frazier, aye. Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Johnson, aye. Representative Edelson.
Aye.
Representative Edelson, aye. Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Feist, aye. Representative Grossel.
Aye.
Representative Grossel, aye. Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Hollins, aye. Representative Hewitt.
Aye.
Representative Hewitt, aye. Representative Cleavorn.
Aye.
Representative Cleavorn, aye. Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Long, aye. Representative Lucero.
Yes.
Representative Lucero, aye. Representative Mueller.
Mueller votes yes.
Representative Mueller, aye. Representative Novotny.
Novotny, aye.
Representative Novotny, aye. Representative O'Neill.
Aye.
Representative O'Neill, aye. Representative Pinto.
Aye.
Representative Pinto, aye. Representative Poston.
Aye.
Representative Poston, aye. Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh, aye.
Representative Raleigh, aye. Representative Vang.
Aye.
Representative Vang, aye. Representative Xiong.
Xiong, aye.
Representative Xiong, aye. And that concludes roll call with 19 ayes.
Very well. 19 ayes, 0 nays. The amendment, A1 amendment, as amended, is adopted. There is an A2 amendment. Is anyone moving the A2 amendment? Not hearing any takers. Very well. There's an A7 amendment. Is anyone moving the A7 amendment?
Representative Novotny.
Very well. Representative Novotny, Representative Novotny moves adoption of the A7 amendment. Representative Novotny.
Trust me, I've had worse pronunciations. So thank you, Chair. My amendment would expand the abuse, the sexual abuse part of the bill, and include persons of authority. Look at several of the cases as testifier Caller Dottie spoke to about Cub Scouts, priest. Do a Google search of teachers and sexual abuse. It'll fill your screen. So I think the anyone in a position of authority should be held to the same authorities. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. There is an A9 amendment that I believe is amending the A7th amendment. Representative Frazier, I believe that might be your amendment.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Botney, for bringing this. This amendment is just refocusing the bill back to the topic at hand. I mean, we're here talking about specific situations, as we heard from testimony around law enforcement. I just like to bring this amendment to refocus us back to that. Appreciate what Representative Botney brought up, but I just want to make sure we stay focused on the issue at hand, and this amendment does that.
Very well. Representative Botney?
I agree, in equal protection for all victims, Chair. Thank you.
Very well. Representative Frazier moves adoption of the A9 amendment to the A7 amendment. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani.
Aye.
Chair Mariani, aye. Vice Chair Frazier.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frazier, aye. Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Johnson, nay. Representative Edelson.
Aye.
Representative Edelson, aye. Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Feist, aye. Representative Grossel?
No.
Representative Grossel, nay. Representative Hollins?
Aye.
Representative Hollins, aye. Representative Hewitt?
Aye.
Representative Hewitt, aye. Representative Cleavorn?
Aye.
Representative Cleavorn, aye. Representative Long?
Aye.
Representative Long? Aye. Representative Lucero? Representative Lucero? Representative Mueller?
Mueller votes no.
Representative Mueller, no. Representative Novotny?
Novotny, no.
Representative Novotny, nay. Representative O'Neill?
O'Neill, no.
Representative O'Neill, nay. Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Representative Pinto, aye. Representative Poston?
Poston, no.
Representative Poston, nay. Representative Raleigh?
Raleigh, nay.
Representative Raleigh, nay. Representative Vang?
Aye.
Representative Vang, aye. Representative Chung?
Aye.
One last call for Representative Lucero. With 11 ayes, 6 nays, and 1 absent, that concludes roll.
Very well. The A9 amendment is adopted to the A7 amendments. Amendments to amendments. All right. Very well. And so now we have the A7 amendment before us. Representative Novotny.
Chair Mariani, thank you. I think we've identified the purpose of the bill here, and we've narrowed it down to what it really is supposed to be doing and what the intent is. And with that, I withdraw my amendment.
Very well. Representative Bobby withdraws the A7 amendment. Members, that concludes the amendments before us. It is the intent of this chair that we will bring this bill back up as amended as we construct our omnibus bill. And so the chair, Representative Vang, I would normally give you an opportunity to say a few words, but unfortunately we are out of time. And so members, the chair then lays the House File 717 as amended over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And members, we are out of time. I do apologize to my friend, Representative Miller on House File 3120. We will prioritize that bill at our next hearing, which will be held on Thursday at our regular time. And so until such time, this committee stands adjourned.